Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY, done with you training, and done for you SEO options. So there is truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist and use the code Modern Therapist for a DIY course or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your consult for special offers.
Are you looking for ways to attract and retain private pay clients? Thryser is a payment platform for therapists built to help clients automatically tap into their out-of-network benefits and save on therapy up front. Check out our special link, join.thryser.com/modern therapist, and use the code Modern Therapists to activate $2,500 in free payments with Thryser.
You're listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide, where therapists live, breathe, and practice as human beings. To support you as a whole person and a therapist, here are your hosts, Kurt Widhelm and Katie Vernoy.
Welcome back, Modern Therapists. This is the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy. And Katie and I have always had this long desire to change just about everything about therapy education and the way that therapists practice. And occasionally, we find time in our heroes' schedules to make it onto our show. And this time, we are so fortunate to have Dr. Daryl Chow joining us for this episode. Dr. Chow is going to be one of our keynote speakers at the Therapy Reimagined 2020 conference. But I'm always excited when we have people who actually do the research to back up the things that we talk about as far as where some of the pitfalls are, where some of the changes need to be in our field, and just so excited to have Dr. Chow. So thank you so much for joining us, Daryl.
Well, I've been such a big fan of your show, so to be on this, it's a treat. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, we're so glad to have you. And like we ask everyone at the beginning of our episodes, who are you and what are you putting out into the world?
And that's the one single question that has been on my mind. You know, you send me a list of stuff to think about on what might be useful for your listeners. This is the one I know you asked this of your interviewees and, you know, it got me thinking quite a bit. So I am a slow learner. You know, I am... You know, when I think about my history, you know, I'm 42. I come from Singapore. I'm a Asian Chinese. I got out of there about 2010, and I'm now living in Western Australia. And recent visit, this is like pre-COVID time back home. I was walking down one of the shopping malls, and I saw a kindergarten preschool girl, and she was wearing her school uniform. And on the uniform, it says, "Pride in performance." And if you know anything about Singapore, performance is everything, right? I mean, we want to be the number one in everything, like number one airport, number one city. You know, even though we were not the number one in Formula One, we just created a new category, night race number one. You know, we're the first to have that. And I say I'm a slow learner with some level of seriousness about that, because when I think about my history, I really failed badly in that kind of system where there was a lot of push for performance. And thinking about that and how I evolved through that, I realized only in the last several years that when we emphasize on performance, it can actually impede learning. You know, when we are over-emphasizing about hitting the right results and the mark, we can actually impede a sense of openness, willingness to take risks and to learn. And I guess that's why I think I'm truly a slow learner. When I do stuff, I do take a lot of more time to process. I need some time to think about things, and you know, it will be like much later that I get it. And I think that also relates to your question about what I'm trying to put out in the world. I'm hoping that we appreciate what what's her name? Susan Rogers, who was a producer for Prince doing the Purple Rain album, working with Prince for about 4 or 5 years. And she said this in an interview that I love, maybe because it's a confirmation bias, but I love the fact that she said that slow progress is real progress. And I just love that, you know, and I think what I'm trying to put out in the world is that I think we can afford the time to become deep learners, each and every one of us. to take the time to metabolize, to learn, and to titrate to how intense we need to learn, what we need to learn, what we need to discover, and probably uncover about ourselves as well.
There you have it, folks. Prince is the basis for everything that we should be doing. So I am always a fan of tearing down the institutions of psychotherapy around everything from the beginning around education to the way that, you know, the systems are built and the ways that we practice and manage care. And through so many of your writings, you talk about the ways that don't work for everybody. Even, you know, you're describing yourself as a slow learner. You're not fitting into this one size fits all therapist model. So kind of starting from the beginning, what do you see is wrong with the way that therapists are educated?
Well, this is the big one. I think we are trying really hard, right? I mean, not that people or academics or people in higher education are doing a bad job. I think we're all trying to do a good job. We're all trying to change and to help therapists in training, especially to develop. But we must understand what is really required is not a downstream effort. It's not something that we need to do just to problem solve and to help people get through the system and pass and get the licensing and all the registration and whatnot. I think the endeavor is a lot of upstream work, you know, and that is difficult. You really need to be intentional, deliberate about this approach. But if I drill down to some specifics, which I talk a lot about in our blog in Frontiers, which is how to reimagine education and psychotherapy, I think one of the key difference is what we would consider in the education system, the banking model versus a kindling model. A banking model is basically just, you know, where we give people the theory practice and then, you know, the theory research and then the practice where we try to give people the cognitive information that they need, all the theoretical stuff, and then get them out to practice much, much, much later, right? Maybe when they are in postgrad on the master's program to do that. I suspect that one way that we need to rethink this is to flip this around, to get people as close as possible to the work, the directedness of the work, which is the conversational nature of reality where we create new experiences for people. And we need to get as close as possible to that, to kindle that piece, and then deconstruct with the theories, philosophies, and all the principles that govern how we work. Because then things get ignited, things get lit up, things get more interesting in that spirit.
And it seems like it would really allow folks to have something to hang the theories on rather than trying to understand something that they haven't yet embodied.
I love that. I love that, to hang on to something. It's what Charlie Munger, the right-hand man of Warren Buffett, saying that, you know, we need a lattice work, a coat hanger to be able to put all our different ideas, right? And to be able to sort of chunk them, because knowledge is multi-level. Knowledge is not just a single piece. It's hierarchical. It's a full network of different ideas. But if we could learn to kind of hang them and to see how all this interlink and how all these connects to you as a person, not just some kind of remote ideas in a book, but with your lived history, with your experiences, is what you bring to the fore into therapy. I think that would be probably worth thinking about. You know, I remember in my undergrad days, I was in this course of counseling module, right? And what Dr. Robert Klaus did for me, you know, probably changed my view. You know, the first lesson he gave, and we all came with this textbook, was it a Gerald Corey textbook maybe? And it was all these different schools of thought, right, that we had to go through. So you kind of know that we'd be covering the landscape of psychotherapy, the field in and of itself. And he said to us after the first hour of introduction, he says, okay, guys, pack your bags. Come, we're going to go to the other room. You know, and other room, okay. And we went there. It looks like an FBI interrogation room, right? Because it's got this one corner where you go in, it's all like soundproof and all that. And then he says that, all right, Majority of you will be seated here, and then, as you can see the reflection of yourself, this is what we call a one-way mirror. And you're going to go to the other side. Two of you are going to go to the other side, and we're going to watch you talk. And then we're like, whoa, wow, okay. And you know, for the first time in my life, not just being a slow learner, right, I was also an anxious kid. So by that time, this is like after 2.5 years in the army, because all males in Singapore have to do that willingly or unwillingly. I was an unwilling one. And I think I was about 21. I told myself, right, screw it, right? You know, stop getting in the way. Just raise your hands to everything and say yes, 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 you know. And before I could think of it, I just say yes. And I say, what did I sign up for? And Candy, a beautiful lady, she's got really colorful hair. She said, oh yeah, I'll do it. And she was really cool about it. And I was like, not so sure. So I followed Candy's lead and I went to the other room. And then Dr. Close just chimes and said, okay, you guys now, just talk.
And I was just like, talk.
Just talk. And then we're like, hello, testing. It's like, we can hear you. And Candy took the lead. I followed her lead. And my one question to her was, I like the color of your hair. Like, why did you do that? And we talked and she told me, but, and then she asked me and we talked. And then after that, he flicked the light on to the other side and he got the team to reflect. I mean, as we know, for some people who are trained in family therapy or system thinking, this is quite a norm. But later did I learn that being in an undergrad psych program, this is not the norm to do mm-hmm. this at the undergrad level. I had no idea. And it really sparked off for me something. It really just opened my eyes to how important to have conversations that we can create safe spaces for truth telling.
Safe spaces for truth telling. I love that. Simplified SEO Consulting's team of mental health professionals genuinely want to help you attract more of your ideal clients with a proven on-page SEO process using the strategies that are most effective for therapist websites. They know SEO is an investment, which is why it is so important to find someone who aligns with your values and understands the importance of building your private practice in a meaningful way. Simplified SEO Consulting hopes to be that team for you and your practice.
The expert team would love to talk with you during a free consultation to figure out the best fit for your SEO journey. Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY, done with you training, and done for you SEO options. So there's truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Be sure to ask if their innovative content network is a good fit for your website. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off a DIY SEO course with code MODERNTHERAPIST or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off your done-for-you SEO program onboarding this spring.
Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern-therapist.
And I've been a fanatic of your blog, of your books over the last couple of years. And this just so wonderfully segues into a lot of what you'd written about in your book, The First Kiss, about even the way that we structure going into those first sessions with clients and right. about how we turn people off in those first sessions. You know, people walk in and it's this, you know, sterile room. Sometimes if you're working in an agency, it's this mountain of paperwork that we have to check through a bunch of boxes and, you know, hanging that hat on something else, especially if you're early in your career. Sum up this whole book in like the next like minute or two, just as far as kind of moving to the next, the next piece of like how right. we just keep getting in our own way when it comes to that transition to actually seeing clients.
That's a good point. How we get in the way. How we get in the way. First off, The First Kiss is not a romance novel.
Don't be kissing your clients.
Yeah, and yeah, professional therapy does not include sex, so no kissing your clients.
But I think I think we get in the way due to in part what we're told to do. What we're told is the right thing to do in our field as counselors, family therapists, psychologists and whatnot, because we are told that we need to take a thorough clinical assessment or an intake. And with that is a whole barrage. You know, you and your listeners and myself, we know all the kinds of questions we need to ask, to check, to make sure that we are doing the right thing, you know, to make sure that we don't miss out on risk, we don't miss out on trauma or salient things that, you know, maybe because we didn't have the time or whatnot, we make sure that we need to cover our grounds. And on top of that, you got to make sure you write your case notes down, you cover those things, cover your ass, make sure that if there's any litigation, you don't get into trouble, right? But I think we need to loosen that up a little bit, to undo the intake perspective and think less about what we are taking and kind of just focus about what we are giving or gifting to people. Because think about it, right? I mean, if you have gone into therapy for the first time, moving and taking the journey and planning and getting there and sitting there with a perfect stranger to talk about yourself, not only talk about yourself, but talk about the thing that pains you, things that are difficult, maybe even shame involved. And then when you leave that, you know, what do you want to leave the person with? You know, when I was writing the book, I used to go to this particular cafe and I would sit down. And on that particular day, there was a guy, you know, was about my age, and he was also sitting with his father-in-law, and they were having coffee. And the father-in-law, after a while, just asked him, so how did it go? How did it go? And then the guy said, what do you mean? Yeah, you saw some psychologist or some shit, right? Like, how did that go? And they said, yeah, you know, I said, I don't understand this business, he said. I spent 1 hour with this person and I paid $180 just for this person to ask me questions. I don't get it. So I think we need to figure out a way to undo that intake perspective, open up the horizon a little bit so that we can kind of go back to the spirit and heart of it to think about what we are giving to people, even from the get-go.
I like that perspective. And I think the thing that for me kind of ties it into business, because if clients feel like they've just been probed and not actually given anything, I think they're not going to be as likely to come back. I think that there's enough folks that have been involved in the medical model that they want to have some probing and some questions. But I think if we don't actually take care of the clients and give them something in that first session, I don't believe that we're going to have the customer service that maybe they would want, we're not starting on a good foot. So to me, I really like this idea of what we're gifting. And I know from myself, the way I look at it is I want them to have something tangible to take with them, whether it's a tool or some sort of something that allows them to feel just a little bit better, feel more hopeful. But I still ask a ton of questions. So I guess my question to you is, how do you kind of get the information that you need to create a formulation, that kind of stuff? Like, what does that trajectory look like if you're not asking a ton of questions in the first appointment?
Yeah, good point. Let me answer to that. But I also want to say that that has a critical implication, because we are not serving fast food, right? We're not just trying to go, you know, one session miracle kind of thing. If mm-hmm. sometimes in some settings, that may be the expectation. But in most situations, it's about continuity of care, a way to follow through. And I think the reason I got compelled to write this book was consulting with individuals and agencies, and, you know, looking at their data sets as we look at their outcomes to help them to, you know, move the needle just that little bit better. And we see that on the average across all countries, right? And all different kinds of settings, the average number of sessions that people typically come for, it's about 4 to 6 4 to 6 is a typical range. Now, even if you're doing long-term therapy, there are, of course, outliers, the people who come longer than that. But on average, it comes about 4 to 6. So the next question is, when we look at that, you know, we look at the trajectory of change, when this change typically happens. And I stumbled upon one piece of other statistical information looking at that was that even though that's the average, think about what is the most common number of sessions that people come for. And in statistical terms, we call that mode. And the modal number of session turns out to be one. One that about 20 to 30% of people come only for one session and then they stop. And I mean, we could argue that maybe they got what they want, but if the plan was from some kind of continuation, then that's unplanned termination. That's not part of the gig, not part of how you set up. And I think when I started to look at that, I thought it was an outlier. So I asked some clinicians, and when I work with other agencies and I saw the same thing, then when I turn back and look at the literature, well, it's a common thing. It's common, and I'm like, why are we accepting this as common as okay, right? I mean, so I went to clinicians and asked them, hey, you know, instead of just kind of vague numbers, tell me, this guy's on your list who came for only one visit. What happened? Do you remember? And they said, who are these guys? Then it struck me that
they didn't even know who they were.
That's right. Because then I look at my own data set, and I will say this with some level of embarrassment. I don't remember some of them as well because I only saw them one time. We have no eyes on an aggregated level, on an individual personal level, because we're so busy. We are inundated with so many different cases to attend to, other side projects, you know. And to me, that's worrisome. And that's how I got started. But let me come back to your point, if I may, Katie. I think the thing about how then do we gather the information to be able to formulate or conceptualize, you know, what how we're going to intervene and help this person. Herbert Simon has this term. Herbert Simon is a renowned decision maker. He calls this satisficing, that instead of getting maximal level of information, or on the flip side, getting minimal amount of information, there may be a sweet spot in between, like an inverted U, that we may just get sufficient that would suffice for the moment. Because information is not transformation. If we gather more information, what happens is our confidence increase because we actually have more knowledge, more information about the person. But it doesn't necessarily translate to better decision making. It just means that you feel more confident because now you have ticked the boxes of what you need to do to get a thorough assessment. But it may not necessarily help you to have a satisfactory level of information that can be helpful for the person. Because after all, as we say, if you work long enough in the field, assessment is always ongoing.
This builds into this idea of first principles that you've written about before. And there's, you know, the different kinds of knowledge that you've described, the conditional, the content, the process knowledge, and kind of this over-reliance on just gathering data, but not necessarily being able to apply it or do anything with it, that ends up just kind of turning some people off, especially in that first session when they're maybe looking at their most vulnerable times for some sort of transformative process, or at least the hope of some sort of transformative process.
That's right.
I'd like to know, what are the first principles? Because I've not read your books. I will now start reading them voraciously, but tell me what the first principles are.
Yeah, you know, that was the other question that I was worried of being asked. Because, you know, we talked a little bit about that in the book, in our recent book, together with two of my heroes, really, Mark Hubbell and Scott Miller. And we addressed this thing about principle-based learning. But in brief, principles are really about the fundamentals, about what Aristotle would call the first basis from which a thing is known, you know, drilling down to that. In fact, Emerson has a quote about, you know, methods that are many, you know, and you can have many methods, but if you have methods and no principles, you're not in a good way. So principles to me are about fundamental way of understanding stuff. So if I could use an analogy here, if you think about music, right, you could think about wanting to create songs. If you are a songwriter, you'd be thinking about some fundamentals, some principles that govern what creates an impactful song, like the format about verse, chorus, verse, bridge, chorus, chorus, right? That creates a scaffold. If you're writing a story, you know, stories go through a narrative arc. They have three acts. They go through a sort of journey, or maybe sometimes what we call in Joseph Campbell's language, the hero's journey. You see this all the time playing out, from Star Wars to Lord of the Rings, and all kinds of movies can be interweaved into this principle of the hero's journey. So I think if you can imagine this, if you could picture that methods are right at the top, and then theories on the second layer, and then right at the bottom are principles. I think we need to focus on that rather on the third piece, which is the principles, instead of just figuring out approaches and methods. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you.
Which seems to be the part that's missing in developing good therapists. In so much of developing research, or the magical model or the magical theory, that we end up spending so much time teaching, you know, evidence-based therapy, that we don't focus so much on building good therapists. And really, you know, there's so much of this difficulty in getting educational institutions, getting postgraduate education to really adopt these ideas. And, you know, you're talking about working with Scott Miller and Mark Hubble and all these ideas around deliberate practice that really gets people to look at why they're doing what it's doing that's successful.
Mm-hmm.
What has been the slow adoption of deliberate practice into the psychotherapy world? Because this, you know, seems to be something that has, you know, especially Scott has been working on since the 90s, that just seems to have so much reluctance around it.
Yeah. Again, borrowing from the analogy about music, I you know, another world that I am obsessed with besides therapy is music. And one thing that I noticed for myself in the domain of music is this: it's so much easier to buy tools than to get good. So I spend a lot of time thinking about therapy, about music, spend a lot of time working on that. And in music, you know, I spend a lot of time looking at gears, or what we call GAS syndrome, which is a gear acquisition syndrome, where, oh, you know, this mixer, oh, this keyboard, oh, this pedal, maybe if I get that, I would then be able to write this song that I'm trying to do. I think that's similar with therapy. You know, if you look at all the feeds and advertisements that's coming up, it's all about this, right? And it speaks to the immediacy. It speaks to some level about our fear of like, oh, not knowing what's the latest evidence and stuff. But, you know, I don't know about you, but the musicians that I really end up enjoying is because you can tell, you have a hint that this is their insights coming out onto the outside, that this is them. This is uniquely this person, even though their voice may sound like not so good, like Bob Dylan, but you know that there's something soulful coming out, and you're moved by that. So I think, you know, Kurt, your assessment about focusing about therapies instead of therapists, it's similar with music. You know, you don't want to get caught up in whether are you doing the technically most proficient stuff, or you're just making a song with three chords. Because at the end of the day, you want to figure out how to to kind of leave yourself behind, paradoxically, and let yourself come through to speak with another person who's also letting themselves come through in the therapy room. So I think it's a phenomena that's not unexpected, that it's slow for uptake. But, you know, of recent years, we see more and more people talking about this whole deliberate practice piece. My worry is this. I'm worried that deliberate practice becomes capital B and capital P, that we are so concerned of this more as a noun than to do the verb. Because if you really stop to think about this, there's a level of dedication involved. There's a level of sweat. And there is no secret formula. There's nothing magical. There's nothing kind of like, if you do this one thing, you know, and then you get better overnight and your clients will come back and thank you. You know, there's no magic formula to this. It's hard work. And yet there is a scaffold. There is a structure that we can offer you to think. Traditionally in the education system, if we can come back to the theme of higher education, is that education tells you what to think. But when you come out in real life, you soon you get a kick in the butt that you need to figure out what to think, what to learn. And I think that's where the rubber meets the road.
Well, it sounds like what you're talking about is that deliberate practice is not even what to think and what to learn, you know, kind of what you should be thinking. It's how to think, right? It's how do I approach this? How do I understand this? How do I assess this in this moment? And it's more really being able to assess and rate your own skills. I know that you have a new book out and, you know, Better Results, that there's a section where you and your co-authors designate a chapter about what is not deliberate practice. So we've talked a little bit in past episodes, and we'll link to them in the show notes, about what deliberate practice is, or at least our understanding of it. But what is not deliberate practice?
Well, the first conflation that we make is that we conflate clinical practice with deliberate practice, because experience does not get us better. You know, I say this with some trepidation because it has lots of implication. We get more confident as the years go by. But as we all know, confidence is not competence. And when we look at the data, Simon Goldberg and colleagues have released a paper a few years ago looking at just this, when clinicians have been collecting outcome data systematically, routinely, using that as a way to guide their work, and composite that across time. And we look at the data to see what happens to each individual clinicians, whether do they actually get better. And if you look at studies from David Olinsky and Michael Ronstadt, that's true. Most clinicians do feel this from the beginning all the way to become a highly experienced or seasoned practitioner. Our confidence to be more healingly involved goes up. But Simon Goldberg's work shows that in spite of that, our confidence plateaus. Our competence, our outcomes does not improve. In fact, on average, there's actually a slight regression downwards. So it's almost like saying if someone has 20 years of experience, it probably means 1 year of experience repeated 19 more times.
Thrizer is a payment platform designed for out-of-network therapy. As a therapist, you would use Thrizer to charge clients for sessions and collect your full rate upfront. From the client's perspective, Thrizer links to their health plan, so insurance claims are automatically submitted for them upon every charge. From there, Thrizer manages the claims end-to-end so that your clients don't have to worry about manually submitting super bills or getting on calls with insurance. The best part? Thrizer allows clients to only pay their co-insurance portion for sessions, while Thrizer covers the rest of your fee and waits for reimbursement on their behalf.
They also offer you an instant benefits calculator for free, allowing you to provide upfront transparency to prospective clients on their out-of-network coverage. Therapists only pay a standard 3% credit card processing fee per session with no additional fees. Visit join.thrizer.com/modern therapist to get started and use our promo code Modern Therapists to receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Once we get to this point in our careers where we feel like we know enough, that we lose some of that hunger to continue to build on that that fire, that kindling that you talk about, that we reach a place of complacency, that it feels like so many of us just kind of lose out on that ambition once we reach a place of comfort within our own lives and our own practice. That really, as I'm hearing you, is the challenge of continuing to be lifelong learners because we have this pitfall, because we have this blind spot.
Yeah. I think that's a challenge. I think, you know, if you speak to therapists of all ages, as well as all nationality, one consistent thing you hear is that we all want to grow. We all want to get better. We all want to do better for our clients. But faced with a lot of upstream efforts, a lot of difficulties in organizations and systemic challenges, I mean, this is hard work. This is hard even just to make the time to do that. So, you know, I think most people do want to get better. Now, remind me again, say your question one more time. I want to make sure I hear you correctly.
It wasn't so much of a question as there's this observation of therapists reach this place of complacency when they feel confident enough.
Yeah. And, you know, that's tricky. That's where we need to counteract that, because when I remember that, you know, I heard one of my colleagues saying that, you know, I spent all these years doing this, you know, and now I get to this point and I should reap the rewards. And then I'm thinking, but isn't this meant to be lifelong? Like, isn't this meant to be something that we do all the way through our careers? But majority of us, you know, we are devoted to that. We feel that there's some need to push that growth edge, that threshold. But the difficulty is figuring out what to work on that actually has leverage for you, because it's not like a blanket thing that everybody should now do this, do A, do B, do C, because for what you need to work on and what I need to work on will be different. That has implication based on where you are at, because, you know, before the days of Google Maps and whatnot, if a friend was to come to your house, right, and he or she rings you, before you can give the instruction, you need to figure out where the person's coming from. And we argue in the book that we need to figure out where you're at before where you need to go. And that means that we need to have a systematic way that we can collate your outcomes one client at a time, session by session, pull all that together with a composite level of close cases, and then examine, all right, how effective you are. Now, remember that we talked about performance at the beginning piece. This can strike terror for some therapists, like to go,
yeah.
Like, okay, am I really effective? What if I suck? What if I'm in the wrong profession? What if, you know, and that is where performance can impede learning, because we need to shift, we need to create spaces to explore each person's growth edge. And one thing, you know, I've been consulting with some master's programs, and even though there may be a slow uptake, but there are people who are putting their heads down, trying to undo the old ways now. And I think we need to acknowledge that. And one thing that's striking is that instead of measuring performance, we really need to figure out a way of measuring growth, a way to kind of track to see how people are willing to figure out first wherever you're at, to figure that out. And then let's kind of help you inch by inch by inch move towards, Vygotsky calls this the zone of proximal development, to get towards your growth edge. And I think that's where it's remoralizing, because if you could do that, and I've seen the payoff for clinicians when they do that, something within just kind of glows and figure out, you know, a way to do this. Because if you could see that what your efforts, where you're banking in is paying dividends, you feel moralized, you feel uplifted to carry on, and that can spread to the other people that you meet as well.
That was one thing I was thinking about when both of you were talking about kind of the complacency that can happen, is I think that there can be a burnout, a lack of desire to learn, giving up. And so this idea of remoralizing people is exciting to me, to actually get to a place where there's more efficacy. And I think those are the types of things that we theoretically are helping our clients with, right? We're helping them to find their areas of confidence, to find those things, and to help therapists in that same way just seems really rewarding. Because I think when I feel most ineffective with clients is when I find myself finding excuses, not wanting to do anything, hoping the client cancels. Like, I'm not saying like, ooh, how do I take this on? And this is fortunately a gross overgeneralization. This was more when I was in agencies and super burned out. But like when I'm struggling, it seems like that's the point at which I want to back down, it's not the point at which I want to take on new learning and understand where I'm faltering.
That's right. That's right. I akin this to a couple of years ago. This is pre-kit time, like before we had kids. You know, my wife and I used to go to the bowling alley, and you know, we just loved the, you know, spending time to throw the ball and chit chat and all that. And to me, in many ways, I'll feel is a bit like going to the bowling alley armed with everything. You know, you got all your gears and you got all the whatever arm bands and you got your nice smooth out bowling ball with your cool white shoes and you're getting ready to bowl. And then you throw that ball time and time again to see if you could hit that strike or that spare, except that your only feedback that you're getting is the sound of the pin. Because you're bowling through a veil, you don't know what happens to the pin, and you're asked to repeat. You're asked to keep going and keep trying. And say, all right, you did well. You heard that sound? Yep, I think that went down. And then keep going and keep, you know. I think we're bowling through a veil, and I think we need to figure out a way to get closer, more proximal towards feedback so that we can feed forward. So, you know, Kurt raised the point about how we are taught about various evidence-based models. I think that's nothing wrong. I mean, that's a thing to learn. But I think to go beyond that just means instead of taking the pill model approach, which is do this thing, adhere to this, make sure you're doing this right? Because one side effect of doing that is you have no flexibility to tweak, to calibrate. Yeah. Continuous tweaking. The only way to tweak that is to quickly take the feedback and feed it forward to go, all right, that worked. That hit the pin. Good. Repeat that. That didn't hit the pin? Oh, adjust your arm a little bit. Maybe stand more to this side, you know, and tweak. I think instead of the pill model approach, we need that kind of continuous calibration approach so that we can figure out how we are doing, not just outsourcing to, you know, because I'm doing some kind of evidence-based model, so that's fine. I mean, we cannot continue to throw the pin over a veil.
I could talk with Dr. Chow for hours about so many things, but we're going to be respectful of his time. And thank you so much for spending your time with us. Where can people find more of you and your information and all of the wonderful writings and books that you're putting out?
Well, it's a treat to be here. So thanks for all the great questions. If you want to find out more, you could go to my website at darylchow.com. And specifically for therapists, you could go to darylchow.com/frontiers. And I have a blog site called Frontiers of Psychotherapist Development. And there's stuff out there for free. You know, I try to put out stuff consistently about this topic and what we are discovering to help you to be at your frontier. And books, links, and all are there. We have got two online workshops that are going on as well, if you're interested. One is about Deep Learner. Maybe I kind of created that course for myself. But I was really, you know, it was only recently launched. And, you know, it was 2 years in the making. And so happened that the launch hit right at the smack of the COVID time. And it's so interesting just hearing people's perspective about wanting to join, not just collect dots, but to connect dots of what they're learning and how this has implications of their client outcomes, whether are they moving the needle, and how to synthesize all that they're doing, how to protect time for play and learning. So that's that. You could find that on my website and also another online web-based workshop called Reigniting Clinical Supervision. This is specifically for clinical supervisors who want to change the way that we're approaching this to actually reap better results. That's all there. And finally, if you are into social media, we have a close group for Frontiers to Psychotherapist Development 2. You can look that up and join in the conversation.
And we will include links to all of those things in our show notes. You can find those at mtsgpodcast.com. And while you're over there, you can check out the now totally live new Therapy Reimagined website. And that's going to have all of our Reimagined conference information. We're reimagining our 2020 conference due to COVID. So all of the latest updates you can find out over there. Dr. Chow is one of our keynote speakers this year. We are so grateful to be able to put together such a wide range of phenomenal speakers. Check all of that out over on the website. And we're able to put that on with the help of our generous sponsor, Simple Practice, Simple Practice Learning, and all the CE information you can find out on the website too. So until next time, I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy and Dr. Daryl Chow.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. Learn more about who we are and what we do at mtsgpodcast.com. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes.
Don't forget, we have some special offers from our partner, Simplified SEO Consulting. Get 20% off a DIY SEO course with the code MODERNTHERAPIST or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off of your onboarding to the Done For You SEO program. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist.
Remember to check out Thrizer. They are passionate about making out-of-network therapy work for everyone. Clients save upfront on therapy while therapists earn their full rate. Get started in minutes on join.thrizer.com/modern therapist and use the promo code Modern Therapists and receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.